You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
So today I wanted to talk to you about President Obama's nuclear agenda, and I also wanted to thank Alexei and Peter for organizing this. I was expecting a very intimate roundtable of just a few people, and so I'm very honored to have all of you here and for us to have a conversation. And I think today's event is actually a perfect example of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in action as a truly global think tank. We endeavor through our activities through all of our offices in Washington, in Moscow, Beijing, Beirut, and Brussels to inform policy debates. And we do this by bringing together, we hope, what is some good independent research and analysis. And for something as complicated as President Obama's nuclear agenda, I think it's great for us to have this kind of opportunity to enrich our understanding of what's happening and what can be reasonably accomplished. So for instance, as we all know, under President Obama, the U.S.-Russian bilateral relationship is undergoing transformation. And that effort is part of a larger endeavor from President Obama to really restore and strengthen the nonproliferation regime. And there are many different facets to that. And this is what, you know, we largely call the Prague Agenda, where last April in Prague, President Obama called for a world free of nuclear weapons. But he also asserted the need for the U.S. to maintain a credible nuclear deterrent for itself and its allies until that vision of a world free of nuclear weapons could be achieved. Balancing those two objectives has been difficult. It has not been easy, and it has had impact on some of the other elements of that agenda. So today, during our time together, I wanted to provide the status of some of these different items, and particularly what challenges and opportunities lay ahead. And I also want to ensure that we have enough time for a broader conversation amongst ourselves. So what I'll aim to do is quickly touch on the START follow-on treaty, the nuclear posture review, the Nuclear Security Summit, the NPT Review Conference, and then on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. And what I've actually done is laid it out. I'll talk about it as they will come up chronologically. And so some of you may be dismayed to see that the CTBT is last, and I'll touch on that as I get to it. But the overarching point that I would like to make today is that domestic politics in the United States is playing a far larger role than some might otherwise believe in terms of how the president will be able to implement this agenda. For some of these issues, the United States Congress, particularly the Senate, plays a large role. There are the obvious cases of Senate ratification necessary for the START follow-on treaty once that's negotiated and signed, as well as for the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. But Congress has also played a role on other key initiatives. For instance, the Nuclear Posture Review is a congressionally mandated effort. Also, the Congress is a key player in budgeting decisions for different agencies and elements of the U.S. government. And this, I'll touch on this a little bit later. This plays into the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty debate and what the role of the U.S. national labs in the nuclear weapons complex is. I'm sure probably even here in Moscow, you've been able to tell how difficult the healthcare reform debate has been for the president and his administration. They've been having a real difficult time of trying to get Republican support for any of its key initiatives, and domestic politics and their domestic policy agenda aside, I think it might be even harder when it comes time for them to try to pass anything that's national security oriented, as are arms control and nonproliferation efforts. There are concerns also that a lot of time and political capital has been consumed by these domestic priorities of healthcare reform, and that while the administration has been busy trying to achieve some success there, they've essentially left open a vacuum where opponents of arms control and nonproliferation have been able to be very vocal and at times even incorrect in some of their concerns. And that's not good for the debate overall, because when the time comes and we do want to send these treaties to Congress, you know, we're going to be fighting already some misinformation. So with that, let me just quickly touch on START follow-on. I'm sure many of you here cover it closely, so I don't want to touch too much on substance. You know, I think our hope is that negotiations will conclude soon, and hopefully it will be signed in time for the 2010 May MPT review conference. I don't know if we'll get ratification by the end of 2010. There are some estimates that probably the last quarter of this year is the earliest when the administration will send up a signed treaty to be considered by the Senate. And we've also seen, and let me just, this the START follow-on treaty is an interesting example of where the domestic politics and the role of the opposition comes into play. We've seen recently from people like Senator John Kyle and Joe Lieberman and John McCain, they've been voicing concerns about whether the Obama administration will be so eager to conclude negotiations that they will compromise specific positions on missile defense. And they've also complained about withdrawal clause provisions in the treaty text. And a lot of these things are just, they're not in line with current thinking. And it's just creating, I think, unnecessary opposition to what's really a very modest arms control agreement. Like, this is not the big reduction between the United States and Russia that President Obama has promised. That's hopefully coming in a follow-on to this follow-on treaty. So there is a reason to be concerned, which is if we're already seeing the beginnings of this kind of opposition for a modest arms control agreement, you can imagine what's going to come next when we start talking about the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. And then just one other item I'd raise with you is there is the perception that part of the difficulty in concluding the agreement comes from the Russian side and concerns about missile defense and other issues. This may be a problem when it comes time not only for ratification of the START follow-on, but for also getting the U.S. Congress to support the Russian 123 agreement. And I know that that's a separate issue about nuclear cooperation between the United States and Russia on other issues. It's something that's been on hold. But what I hear from people who are in charge of this in Washington is that the Russian effort in Washington isn't, for instance, as organized as the UAE effort was to secure their own 123 agreement. And you have to remember that Congress is full of politicians, and when it comes time for them, and hopefully the day will come, where they will look at the Russian 123 agreement, they're going to remember these kinds of, you know, in their mind, what looks like foot dragging on START follow-on, and it's going to count against them. And we already see this from some Republican politicians who talk about whether Russia deserves to have a START follow-on treaty, whether they deserve to engage in arms control with us. And I say this not because reasonable people agree with them, but just to give you a sense of where some of the opposition is and some of the language and some of the concepts they're using to promote their view. The next thing that I think we can expect to have happen is the nuclear posture review. It has been delayed again. It was originally supposed to come out in December 1st. It got pushed back to February 1st. It got pushed back to March 1st. Unofficially, they said mid-March now, and they wouldn't commit to a date because they knew that that would likely slide again. My best guess is that we will actually see a document probably come out sometime in mid to late April. And the reason I say that is that it has to be presented to Congress. It's a congressionally mandated document, and it has to be presented to them. Congress doesn't convene again until April 12th. So you may see a presidential statement ahead of time. President Obama might, you know, provide some of the elements in a speech, but the actual document I don't think will come until late April. In terms of the substance, though, of the nuclear posture review, as you may know, this is meant to be an expression of the role and purpose and missions of U.S. nuclear weapons for the next 5 to 10 years. And I think we can expect to see some improvements in U.S. declaratory policy, but there is right now a debate about language that will be used. Where will this document say that the sole purpose of U.S. nuclear weapons is to deter nuclear attacks against the U.S. and allies, or the primary purpose is to deter nuclear attacks against the U.S. and allies? So there is a debate about sole versus primary. Sole is very defined versus the use of primary. It opens up some ambiguity about when else U.S. nuclear weapons might, or what the other purposes of U.S. nuclear weapons might be. I think we're unlikely to see a no first use declaration, although there are people who've strongly tried to advocate for that. I don't think we'll see it, but maybe there'll be some clarification about the role of U.S. nuclear weapons as it affects non-nuclear weapon states, particularly those that are compliant. And I think the one thing to keep in mind politically about the nuclear posture review is that it'll come out just a few weeks before the May 2010 NPT review conference, and I think it will be looked at very closely as an indication of President Obama and his administration's seriousness about disarmament. And the reason I think it will be looked at closely is that other elements of the agenda are not proceeding as quickly as we had once hoped. Where a year ago, if you talked to National Security Council officials, they used to say, oh yeah, we'll get the CTBT ratified by the review conference. I mean, that just seems like such a pipe dream right now. I don't think we're going to see any movement on CTBT until probably next year. So what are you left with? Start follow-on. Again, it's a modest arms control agreement. Maybe it'll be signed before the review conference. And so essentially, you basically have the nuclear posture review. There is one other thing that will happen, and it's unclear to me that the substance of this event will have an impact on the review conference, but I think some of the activities around the nuclear security summit, I think, actually can have a tremendous impact on whether we see success or failure at the review conference. The nuclear security summit is happening on April 13th in Washington, D.C. I think at last count, there are 46 countries expected to participate, and this is at the head of state level, plus a few other people. And this is part of President Obama's campaign promise to secure all nuclear weapons material that is vulnerable within 4 years. And from what I understand, this is really an effort to galvanize political will on a lot of the international programs that have been set up over the last few years. There's a sense in Washington that some governments have kind of lost their energy for some of these efforts, and this summit is meant to be an opportunity to put the spotlight on those issues and to try to get states to make statements about what they're doing on this issue to secure vulnerable materials and to combat nuclear terrorism. You can expect, in terms of a product, a 1 to 2 page communique. This will have been negotiated likely in advance, so I don't think it's going to be a surprise to anybody who's attending the security summit. One interesting development is that there is a concurrent non-governmental organization summit that will happen the day before and a little bit overlapping with the official summit. This is done with the blessing of the Obama administration, and it involves a lot of international NGOs. And the reason they're doing this is they want to make sure that there's accountability after the summit, that the summit doesn't happen and everybody comes and makes very nice statements about what they're going to do on securing vulnerable materials and then goes away and nothing happens. It's instead about trying to create accountability and using NGOs to do that. So the real benefit, though, I think, from the Nuclear Security Summit will be the head of state contact. This will be a chance for President Obama to pull to the side really key leaders from Egypt, South Africa, Brazil, and hopefully whisper in their ear or perhaps twist their arm a little to make sure that we have more positive outcomes at the NPT review conference. I think it's becoming clear that there are going to be a few states that may determine whether we see even modest success at the review conference, and I think it's going to require some U.S. leadership to find some common ground amongst those states. So on that, let me just talk now about the review conference. As you know, this takes place once every 5 years. It's a month-long conference of all states party to the NPT, and it will take place at the UN in New York. I think it's a key opportunity for President Obama to push forward a lot of the concepts that he laid out when he chaired the UN Security Council back in September, where there was Resolution 1887 that was passed. And that, I think, laid out a lot of that administration and a lot of other countries' understanding about what could be done to strengthen the nonproliferation regime. So although the review conference is an opportunity, it is not without its challenges. And as many of you probably know, there are significant limitations to how the review conference actually operates as an international legal instrument. There's no standing secretariat, there are a lack of enforcement provisions to the NPT overall, and there's also a lot of procedural politicking, such as the challenge of trying to get universal consensus in order to support any action. And this comes into play when we talk about a final consensus declaration as a measure of success for the review conference. I don't think it should be, and I'll touch on that in a little bit. But because of universal consensus rules where everybody needs to agree, not the majority, but actually everybody, that actually creates the conditions for what we call spoiling behavior, where one or a few states can really just wreck this conference. And we've seen this more recently in 2005, which most people agree was an unmitigated disaster. And depending on who you talk to about it, either the United States, Egypt, or Iran is to blame. So you have a selection of states to select from. But I think it's important to acknowledge the limitations of the review conference because it leads us to ask, well, why should we care? So this thing happens every 5 years. There are a few preparatory committee meetings in the meantime. Why does this really matter for the nonproliferation regime? And I think we have a few answers for that. One comes in the form of what's actually at stake. And what I would argue is that equity issues are what's at stake. And for nuclear weapon states and Iran's neighbors, there are doubts about the security benefits of the regime. Is Iran cheating from within the regime? And if so, if there are no consequences for it, what does that actually mean for the regime overall and how well it functions? But I think for other non-nuclear weapon states, their faith in the equity of the regime is what hangs in the balance. And this is the usual debate that we hear about, are nuclear weapon states doing enough on disarmament, and the nuclear weapon states, particularly the United States and others, wondering whether non-nuclear weapon states are doing enough on non-proliferation. So in this way, I actually think the review conference is an opportunity to restore that faith, but it's going to take a lot of work. And it feels like, to me at least, that time is running out. So I don't have the most optimistic view about what can happen at the review conference. Because I think we need to acknowledge that in some ways the review conference is a paradox. And it's a paradox in that even achieving modest results will require enormous amounts of political will and effort. But since failure will come with serious consequences, I think it's worth states trying to make an effort to avert such an outcome. Just one other note about why I think the review conference is important is it is the one opportunity for states that are otherwise disenfranchised from the other elements of the nonproliferation regime decision-making mechanism. So, for instance, the Nuclear Suppliers Group, the Conference on Disarmament, the UN Security Council even. At any given time, the vast majority of states that are party to the NPT don't have a seat in those decision-making forums. So for them, the review conference is their one chance, once every 5 years, to voice their concerns about whether the NPT is actually being implemented in the way it was intended. I personally think that the future of the non-proliferation regime relies strongly on what non-nuclear weapon states will decide to do going into the future. If that's the case, and particularly these states that come from the non-aligned movement and are critical of the non-proliferation regime, if that's the case, then I think it's worth trying to engage these states in one of the forums that they deem to be legitimate for dealing with these issues. There are two developments I think that will influence prospects for success or failure in May. One is what happens with Iran, and the other is the perception of the reemergence of U.S. leadership on nonproliferation. In terms of Iran, I think if we continue to see defiance from them and toothless UN Security Council resolutions, I think it's going to create incentives in one of two ways. It'll either create the urgency to actually strengthen the non-proliferation regime, and maybe we'll see some movements on issues like Article 10, the withdrawal clause, or it's going to create incentives for certain states to keep the regime weak because they're concerned about the security threat from Iran. So I think Iran can play, I think we'll see that play out one way or the other at the review conference. Although I hope for that there would be more urgency, my concern is that we might in fact see states such as Egypt or other neighbors of Iran probably playing more of an obstructionist role. In terms of the positive development, which is President Obama and his administration's perceived leadership in nonproliferation, I think it has the power to be a game changer, but I think we need to remember that review conferences are mile markers, and I guess actually since I'm in Moscow, maybe I should say kilometer markers, where it's not this moment in time that matters, or I'm sorry, not that it matters. That's not what's being reflected. What's being reflected is the previous 5 years. And the previous 5 years, I don't think have been very good ones for the issues that the review conference tries to assess. And so for me, it feels a little naive and premature to think that just because President Obama a year ago came out and made these great declarations, and we've already talked about the challenges to even implementing a lot of his vision, that just because he did that a year ago, that everything can change in May. I mean, I think we really need to look at that a lot of time has been lost. And even in the preparatory committee meetings that have happened, you know, the first two, I think, were not very productive, and we only started to see movement in the last preparatory committee meeting. So, you know, and the other thing to talk about in terms of President Obama is what I call the Obama effect on expectations. His speech has created tremendously high expectations about what can be achieved. And for some people, that is a double-edged sword. And on one hand, it can create such high expectations of what should be achievable that you might not be able to get anything. And that's when, you know, where people want so much and it's just not realistic. And on the other hand, it can also encourage brinksmanship, where states that aren't looking to be constructive or productive members of the discussion know that there's a lot at stake, and they will try to, they can try to bring the house down because of it. So, you know, from my standpoint, I think there's several things that actually could happen if there was enough political will and if there was really an effort to engage in tough negotiations. I've written a report that's called Restoring the NPT Essential Steps for 2010. It's available online. I won't bore you with all the details of it here, but I will just give you some few highlights of actually what I think is achievable. I think the first thing that is achievable is reaffirming the vitality of the NPT. This is my version of the reset button that's been discussed in the U.S.-Russian bilateral relationship and trying to apply that to the nonproliferation regime. And the idea behind it is that I think some states have lost sight of the fact that the nonproliferation treaty confers security benefits to all of them. And although there have been questions about that in certain areas, for the vast majority of states, the NPT does do that. And I think we need to kind of clear away some of the confusion and some of the angst and get people and get states to reaffirm that. And they could do that individually in their opening statements. They could do it in regional statements as well. I think another way to do that is a P5 statement that reaffirms the vitality of the NPT and could also offer negative security assurances to at least compliant non-nuclear weapon states. I don't think we're going to get that. I think it would take a lot more political will than it's currently there, but I think that would have been a good measure of success. Some of the other things that I think could be helpful are reiterating the unequivocal undertaking to eliminate arsenals. This is part of the 13 steps that was agreed to at the 2000 NPT review conference. And this is about being sensitive to the current political moment and to address the credibility problem that nuclear weapon states are facing from non-nuclear weapon states. I also think that just reaffirming that broader concept is the first step towards updating the 13 steps. And I think there's a lot of agreement from most states that the 13 steps, they're just not relevant. And I actually, what I try saying to some non-nuclear weapon states who are really very concerned about trying to, what they call, reopen or renegotiate them, is they should realize that the 13 steps as written don't actually work in non-nuclear weapon states' favor. The nuclear weapon states were clearly not held as accountable as they could have been because of the way some of these benchmarks were written. And we could talk more about it in the Q&A, but some of them are just analytically at completely different levels, and, you know, and some have been overtaken by events. On the issue of peaceful uses of nuclear energy, for me, I think the nuts and bolts of nuclear industry and civilian nuclear energy programs, I think it gets decided in other arenas. It gets decided in the nuclear suppliers group. It gets decided in the private sector by companies deciding whether they're going to sell reactors or engage in nuclear trade with other countries. But what I think the NPT review conference can do is clarify a lot of the confusion from the last few years, where there have been so many different proposals and concerns from non-nuclear weapon states that their rights were being abridged or in some way constrained. And the way that I approach this is to remind everybody that the NPT does not confer the right to peaceful uses of nuclear energy. That right exists outside of the NPT. But what the NPT does is that it acknowledges everybody's right to peaceful uses of nuclear energy, and then it says, if you want help in exploring the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, well, you have to take on some obligations. You know, and we see this play out in the narrative that Iran has used, that, you know, the current confrontation with them is about the West trying to oppress their rights and that they're not doing anything wrong. Well, that's not what it's really about. You know, from, I think, any reason person's point of view, the Iranians had certain legal obligations. They have failed to fulfill all of them. And the international community has come back several times laying out what Iran needs to do to rebuild confidence again with the international community. I do think some progress can be made on nuclear weapons-free zones, and particularly in the Middle East. At least, you know, when I talk to Egyptian diplomats about this, they say that their point of view on this has become more and more moderate with the last three preparatory committee meetings for the NPT. And then I think the Egyptians have played an important role in trying to create some accountability to the 1995 Middle East nuclear weapons free zone resolution. I think at the very least, perhaps a special representative could be appointed from the Secretary General of the UN, and that there should probably be some kind of regional conference in the next year or so to just start the conversation about what would be necessary to try to make progress. The last few things I'll touch on in terms of what's actually achievable is probably statements affirming the additional protocol and its importance. The IAEA has now come out strongly saying that without the additional protocol in force and comprehensive safeguards agreements, they have less confidence in their ability to verify that states are pursuing purely peaceful nuclear energy programs. I think we need to listen to the IAEA when they say that about what's necessary if we want them to continue doing their job in ensuring and making us feel secure about the nuclear programs of other states. The last thing I'll just say is on the withdrawal clause. This is Article 10. There's a lot of proposals out there. I think there are about nine. They range from being very legalistic and very specific language from some states to one proposal, which is always offered by Iran, which essentially states that this is not an issue and we shouldn't look at it. I think that some of the non-aligned movement states in particular kind of need to look at what's happening here, you know, where Iran, I think, is trying to they're doing their best. I don't know if they'll be successful, but they're trying to manipulate the agenda and some of the debates at the review conference for their own interests. And I'm not sure that really makes sense. I think that as states that care about the NPT and making sure that we don't have more nuclear weapon states, I think we should be able to find some agreement about what should be done for states that are non-compliant and then try to leave the non-proliferation regime. So meaning they've cheated from within, should there really be no consequences for that? Should we really not have very clear procedures about that? So I think that that's a place where the NPT Review Conference could make a unique contribution, and I think it's best that it be done at the review conference rather than in the UN Security Council. I think that it's, you know, with UN Security Council Resolution 1540, there were concerns from states like South Africa and other non-aligned movements that they saw that as the UN Security Council overstretching its authority, and that it was basically creating legally binding commitments for all states. Yet that was decided by just the UN Security Council, which is just a small group of states. I don't think we want to see that kind of that feeling repeated if the UN Security Council decides that it needs to make some decisions about clarifying the withdrawal clause. So that's why I really urge states to take it up where it should be taken up, which is at the NPT Review Conference. Just a note on success and failure. I think it's a mistake for us to, A, think of the review conference as a make or break moment for the nonproliferation regime. I don't think that's the case. I think there's a lot more resilience in the nonproliferation regime than what will be determined at the end of these 4 weeks. But I do think we need to see a little bit more political entrepreneurism from states in terms of what are alternative ways to capture success. It would be great if everybody could agree to a substantive, meaningful, progressive, final declaration. I don't think that's going to happen. So in lieu of that, I think we should look at other ways of gauging success. One, for instance, is can we find ways of elevating the president of the NPT review conference's statement? Can he capture in some way some of where there is broad agreement? So not maybe everybody agrees, but if the vast majority agree, can we use that and try to pay attention to that? Can we see individual or group statements on specific issues? So for instance, if there was a group of countries or an individual state that said, you know what, we're going to adopt the additional protocol, they should announce that. They should do it at the review conference. Call that a win, you know, in some ways on some issues and try to move on. Can we see on the withdrawal clause that there will be a set of countries that say that they will be the folks that will move, that they will meet in an ad hoc fashion, maybe similar to the Nuclear Security Summit, and try to, you know, come up with some real proposals and gain some consensus for the next time NPT states meet. But I think there's one other way of measuring success, and it's a little bit more oblique, and that is how are would-be spoilers treated? Are their arguments accepted? Do people pay attention to them? Or are they sidelined? Are people more skeptical about them? I think that's a really important measure to look at, and one that's oftentimes ignored. You know, what I've heard from, and when I was at the last review conference, at the last preparatory committee meeting, when I asked about Iran and how states were looking at them, one of the comments was, you know what, we've all heard this. We're all tired of the same statements, and they're largely being ignored. I think that's an important measure about whether multilateralism in this kind of messy context can actually work or not. So I think this leaves us with one more element of President Obama's agenda, and that's the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. I think it's an excellent example where the will of the president is not enough, and where it'll be important to understand whether the international community understands this kind of domestic political challenge. In his Prague speech, he said that he would aggressively and immediately seek ratification of a Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Again, some people thought that would happen within a year. Now we're thinking more it's 2011 at the earliest, but there are other complications. This administration knows that CTBT will be an order of magnitude harder to achieve ratification for than START follow-on. And they also know that they will not put up the treaty for ratification if there's any sense that it will not succeed. For the CTBT to fail twice in the United States will be the death of the CTBT. I don't think you can expect to see it on the American agenda anytime soon. So because of that, you see an administration that's taking a more careful approach to this. And if you ask them about it, they talk about their approach as one of being laying out their argument. And because of that, there are a few studies that will come out soon that will bear on the debate. One is from the National Academies of Arts and Sciences, where they're doing a technical review of the verification capabilities of the CTBT. You can expect that to come out sometime in March or April. There is also, I believe, a national intelligence estimate on the verification capabilities of the CTBT. That's expected to come out at the end of March. I don't know if that will be on time or not. And the idea is that all of these studies and some other maneuvering will help pave the way for support, particularly from the National Nuclear Weapons Labs, where what the administration wants to avoid is a repeat of what happened over a decade ago, that when they were asked the question, can we certify that the, and can we assure ourselves that the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal is reliable without testing, they want to make sure there's no equivocation on that answer. And so what you saw recently was a big speech by Vice President Biden where he lays out a lot of the investments that this administration is willing to make. And you see that particularly in terms of budget increases for the nuclear weapons labs. One thing that I think the administration needs to be more clear about, and what I'll try to do right now, is clarifying what exactly is happening with that money. Because there are people from who can look at it and think, this is about modernization in terms of modernizing nuclear warheads. But what the administration will tell you that that's not what this is for, and instead this is about shoring up some really old, crumbling facilities and ensuring that the nuclear weapons complex has the right skills in terms of scientific and technical people who will need to do continued work on the stockpile and also when the time comes for further dismantlement and verification measures. I think one boost, though, came from Indonesia, where last June their foreign minister actually came to Carnegie in Washington and gave a speech where he said Indonesia promises to immediately ratify the CTBT after the United States does. This was a big deal, and it really helped the State Department and the Obama administration. And it would be great if other Annex II states, those states that are necessary to sign and ratify the CTBT for it to enter into force, if they were willing to make similar statements. You know, I think it's a real challenge for the nonproliferation regime if everything or if a lot of things seem to rely on U.S. leadership. So either people hide behind the U.S. when the U.S. isn't being progressive enough, or it really requires the U.S. to kind of poke states to get them to move. But one element that hasn't changed is the staunchest opponent to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, who is Senator John Kyle. He's still in office, and he is still working very hard to ensure that the CTBT will not be ratified. And, you know, I've heard privately that he has said that defeating the CTBT was the, you know, biggest success of his career, and that he will work hard to ensure that it stays dead. And the problem with that is that it completely ignores over a decade's worth of scientific progress and technical advancement, and it just completely ignores, I think, the security situation that we're in today. So our hope is that, you know, with these new studies, with the support of the administration, with international organizations and foreign governments making clear what their positions are on the CTBT, that it'll be easier to try to combat a lot of the misinformation on it and to try to get the political support necessary. And as you may know, you need at least 67 votes of the Senate in order to ratify treaties. Those 67 votes are going to be hard to come by for this administration. It is likely that we usually count that Democrats and independents will vote for it, and then it's a matter of can you get 7 to 12 Senate Republicans to come on over. And in the upcoming midterm elections, it's likely that the Senate will lose a few more Democratic senators. So it's going to make it even harder. So the last thing I'll say is I know this probably seems like a really grim assessment of all these different elements, but I do think it's important to highlight really what the challenge is here, that just because President Obama wants something to happen, it's not always as easy as that, and I'm sure that's true for many governments. So with that, I hope it was helpful and that we can engage in some Q&A.
Thank you, Dipti, very much for your very comprehensive statement. We are not frightened by the grim picture, because if you listen to debates on nuclear weapons here in Russia and compare it to what you present a very bright picture. Я сказал, что те, кто не знает английского, что нас не пугает эта мрачная картина, потому что у нас дебаты еще более жесткие идут по этому вопросу. But thank you anyway. It was very comprehensive and interesting presentation. Пожалуйста, у кого есть вопросы, задавайте на английском языке. Кто не может, мы вам поможем. Пожалуйста, господин Становский.
Okay, well.
Пожалуйста, сначала вопросы. У кого есть вопросы в виде комментария, попозже.
Eugene Stanovsky, president of Moscow Institute for the Near Eastern Studies. First, thank you for the brilliant presentation. And I have two brief and easy questions. If Iranian regime will not feel weak, is it military option on the Obama's administration, and what type of red lines you have for this military option? The second question, if after all these long discussions about sanctions and this talk show in UN, so on, we'll understand that we have Iranian nuclear bomb, what administration will do? Say goodbye non-proliferation regime or something else?
Like to take several questions,
sure,
or
that's fine.
One
yep.
by one.
Go ahead. We can take.
Давайте еще два-три вопроса, и потом Дипти, пожалуйста.
Okay. Thanks for your very interesting speech. My name is Alexey Finenko. I'm from Institute of International Security Studies, and I have two questions for you. My first question is about CTBT. You said a lot of CTBT, but my question is, in your opinion, does this document have the perspectives in Congress today for the ratification or not? It is my first question about the CTBT. And my second question is about the fissile material cutoff treaty. You say something about this document, and does the Obama administration, in your opinion, have some practical measures for these documents? Thanks.
И, пожалуйста, еще один вопрос. Вот дама слева сидящая.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to compliment you for a very amazing presentation. And if you would allow me, I would like to make a comment. Actually,
comments, if you please, a little bit later. But also, please represent yourself.
I apologize for that. I'm Maria Sultan from South Asian Strategic Stability Institute. And my question is this, that with reference to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, you said it would be a good idea for other states to supplement the U.S. Ratification process in terms of coming up with statements. How do you foresee that, considering the fact that U.S. has itself, and for example in South Asia, been responsible for altering the deterrence equation over there with the reference to the Indo-U.S. nuclear deal in the region, with the reference to the ballistic missile defense program, and it definitely puts the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty on the back burner. What, in your opinion, could be actually given to the region in order to bring these state parties back on the CTBT debate?
Okay, those are great questions. On the issue of Iran first, you know, you always hear the statement from any administration that no option is off the table, but what we have heard that's different in the Obama administration than the Bush administration is that you have heard military leaders like Secretary Gates and others say very clearly that there is a preference for diplomacy over action. But I think that there's a lot of people in the administration who don't see how the use of force will really work in the long term. I mean, although there is a sense that, yes, you could conduct some kind of strikes, we don't even know where all the facilities are, and it would probably even further embolden, Iran's narrative with other states. You know, what would be the point? You would set it back a few years, and then, and then what? So I think that there is a concern that it doesn't actually lead to the resolution we want. And I also think that there would not be a lot of public support for that kind of action. You know, let's remember that in 2003, the entire justification for the U.S. invasion of Iraq was that, you know, we had concerns that Saddam Hussein had what was conveniently called weapons of mass destruction, you know, and for Americans, the picture that was painted for them by Condoleezza Rice, where she actually used the phrase, we don't want evidence coming in the form of a mushroom cloud, is that it implied that Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons, when in fact it was widely understood that at best he had chemical and biological weapons. I think that hangover still exists, and so I think that there are going to be a lot of concerns about trying to use a military option. That said, what's not clear to me and to others is the Israeli position and how coordinated or not it is with the Obama administration. So a lot of the statements that are being made by the Israelis, and I think it's very helpful that they've gone to the Chinese and asked them to really try to see that this is a real concern for their security and that China should back sanctions, you know, some of the statements that were made in the fall and up until recently about, you know, Israel being willing to take action, you know, is that a real threat? Or is that part of an Israeli effort to try to increase the cost of the Iranians continuing down its current path? And I don't know the answer to that. And I think the, you know, the U.S.-Israeli relationship is undergoing some transformation on some issues. In terms of sanctions and what do we do if Iran has a bomb, I just feel like there are a few assumptions in that statement that we probably need to call out. You know, one is, what is the purpose of sanctions? For some people, they talk about it that it will actually stop, you know, the Iranian enrichment program forever. I don't think that's the actual purpose of sanctions. I think the purpose of sanctions is to raise the cost of the Iranians continuing down this path and try to get them to the negotiating table. I think they missed an excellent opportunity to restore faith with the international community with this Tehran Research Reactor LEU deal. They're in such political disarray, they couldn't get themselves to say yes. They would have actually, I think, gotten a lot of benefits if they had done it. So for me, I just want to say on sanctions, you know, that I think it has another purpose. And in terms of Iran having a nuclear bomb, what exactly are we talking about here? Are we talking about the capability, which has several components to it, which is having stockpiled low-enriched uranium or having stockpiled, you know, weapons-grade material? Are we talking about them actually conducting further weaponization activities? Are we talking about them actually conducting a test and, you know, revealing that they have a nuclear weapons capability? If they did that, I don't think they're doing it if they only have one nuclear weapon or material from one nuclear weapon. So I think we're talking about a longer time horizon and a lot of different scenarios. And I also hope, I mean, my hope is that the Iranians are smart enough to realize that the worst thing they could do for their security in terms of their relations with their neighbors is to actually declare a nuclear weapons capability. I think that would spur other proliferation in the region, and I don't think that's to anybody's benefit. So you clearly have, just judging by your facial expressions, or disagree with me, but that's at least my take on it. Alexei, in terms of your questions about the CTBT, I just wanted to make sure I understood it. You're asking me whether Congress, their perspectives. So the problem is that the CTBT, as an element of all of this broader agenda, it just hasn't gotten the visibility yet. So a lot of the efforts to educate members of Congress are very low level. For instance, they're coming from experts and members of NGOs who are trying to go in there and try to educate them. I think what you'll find is that Democratic senators are very supportive of it. The problem is that the last time a treaty was considered by this Congress, 40 of the existing senator, I'm sorry, the last time a treaty was considered for ratification by the U.S. Senate, there are currently 40 senators who never had any experience with that. So there's also an education effort about how does the Senate go about ratifying a treaty. So that's another political problem on top of the substantive one, which is, are they up to date on all the progress and advancements that have happened in the last 10 years? The hope is that with some of the newer Republican senators, that they won't have an ideological objection to it, that they can be persuaded and educated to take a more reasonable view. That said, if Republican Party leadership sends out the word that they are not going to support anything that President Obama has to do, I think that makes everything a lot more difficult, and that's a big problem. On the FMCT, I don't think this is up to the United States. I think this is up to some other states in the Conference on Disarmament deciding to let the program of work go ahead. There have been some discussions last year about trying to take an alternative approach and taking it out of the Conference on Disarmament. You know, my particular view on it is that, you know, things like that really should happen in the bodies in which they were intended, even though that's very frustrating for a lot of us, that it's a very long period of time that goes by before there's any progress made in those forums. But again, I don't think it's up to the United States. And then, Maria, on your question about the CTBT, you're absolutely right. I mean, the U.S.-India deal, I think, was a very big setback for nonproliferation and disarmament in South Asia and in other parts of the world. You should know that I did not support the deal. I have, you know, real concerns about making a huge exception for the, you know, for some countries and the ripple effects of it and the unintended consequences of it. And I think one of them is exactly the CTBT. And by the way, I should just tell you, I mean, I think, you know, India and Pakistan, for me, are kind of further down the list of possible ratifications on the CTBT. I think what we could probably more immediately see is, you know, if you could, you know, mount the right arguments and get the United States to ratify. The conventional thinking is that China actually would, and either right before the U.S. or right after. We now have this Indonesian commitment. That's three of the nine. So that's one third. That, you know, I for right now, I'd consider that big, you know, pretty good progress. Then you also have the Israelis who, under the Olmert government, had made indications that they would be willing to ratify the CTBT. They also said that they would do it in exchange for a similar kind of deal with the nuclear suppliers group. But I think the reality is that the Israelis don't need to test, and we could probably, or you know, lots of people could probably persuade them to eventually ratify. And what does that leave? It leaves five countries who are all members of the Non-Aligned Movement. And the Non-Aligned Movement, in their July 2009 summit, expressed support for the CTBT. And I think we're going to see a really interesting political dynamic where the Non-Aligned Movement constantly asks for more progress on disarmament, and they will be faced as they will be faced with this measure of, you know, being a key actor that sees progress, you know, on that step. So, and I think they're going to have to deal with some of the challenges in their own house. So, you know, I agree with you, the U.S.-India deal was not, did not in any way facilitate disarmament and nonproliferation, but I think it's a fluid situation. I think the global war on terrorism and Afghanistan-Pakistan issues play into it. You know, we have the bilateral talks between India and Pakistan. I think we're going to have to see how a lot of those things play out over the next few years before we can have any real conversation about the CTBT.
Thank you, Deputy. I have an idea about facilitating ratification of CTBT in the U.S. Senate. Here in Russia, we have a very big school of strategic thought, very serious people, a lot of them military, some civilian experts, who are claiming that the whole idea of nuclear disarmament is a great and evil trick on the part of the United States, because Americans have enormous superiority in conventional forces, in new precision-guided long-range conventional strategic systems, in space, in ballistic missile defense, and so they want to do away with nuclear weapons to become once again a superpower in all respects. So these people should go to American Senate and tell that American senators, maybe they will persuade them that is a good idea and facilitate.
Right, and with Russia having already ratified, you know, what could you do?
Well, Russia has ratified this.
Right. Well, you know, but just on the Russian issue, one thing that has come up, and this is particularly amongst intelligence analysts and opposite, you know, people who oppose the CTBT, they've raised questions about the Russian understanding of the CTBT and whether it actually, you know, bans all tests. And, you know, I know Ambassador Slepchenko has done some great work on this, and I believe even President Medvedev made a statement recently that the Russian understanding is that it includes all tests. but it's likely that we'll probably need a few more official statements for that to sink, that message to sink in Washington. So that kind of, you know, that's what I call a red herring, and I think that that's, I think that's been raised in Washington, and we'll have to shoot it down.
We are planning a special sub-project in Moscow Carnegie Center using the experience and knowledge of Dr. Slipchenko to get deeper into these issues and to invite Russian experts and officials to comment. And in this way, to facilitate ratification after, of course, the whole big debate over start for follow-on right. is finished. Пожалуйста, другие вопросы. Пожалуйста.
Thank you, Ms. Chubai. My name is Roy Rosenblit from the Embassy of Israel to the Russian Federation.
Well, maybe you can answer those questions then.
So. I'm afraid I'm not going.
Speak up, please. Right now. Speak up.
But thank you for this very interesting presentation. With your permission, I would like to go back a little bit to the review conference, to the NPT review conference. And you mentioned that during the conference, I mean, the consensual character of this conference maybe cause or at least enables spoiling activities from different parties if they want to. And you mentioned also what Egyptian colleagues maybe have told you about their position or and so on and so forth. And what I want to ask is what can be done maybe to keep the main issues in focus and not to let the review conference be abducted by particular interests such as you mentioned non-aligned movement or maybe subjects like the nuclear weapon free zone in the Middle East or things like that that maybe divert that may divert the conference to sidetrack. So what can be done maybe to avoid that?
Great.
Thank you.
Terrific. I actually have a few responses about what can be done. One comes from other diplomats that I have interviewed about this, and what they argue for is a strategy of engage or ignore. And what they say is basically, look, why don't you try engaging some of these states on the issues that they say are necessary for them so they feel like somebody's taking them seriously so that they don't have an incentive to try to, you know, ruin everything. And the other thing is to ignore, which is if it becomes just too disruptive, show that it's not having any effect. So I think that's, you know, that's one thing. I don't know how it actually will play out in reality, but it's one of the suggestions they give. The second thing is on the non-aligned movement, it's an effort to really try to educate a lot of the smaller and poorer non-aligned movement countries. A lot of them send very small delegations. Some of them can't send delegations at all to the review conference. And they don't have deep technical expertise. You know, the diplomat that's been assigned this portfolio may not know all the intricacies of some of these issues. So what we've tried to do, particularly in the NGO and civil society world, is trying to go to New York and trying to do those kinds of briefings so that they don't default to what the NAM leadership position is. And as some of you know, Egypt is currently the chair of the NAM for 3 years, and by 2015, Iran is anticipated to be the next chair of the NAM. So these are, you know, this is where it's really worth trying to engage these other states and educate them so that they can make their own decisions, so that they're not just going along, you know, with the flow. Another thing I would suggest is the role of NGOs in terms of creating accountability. And one of the things I've tried arguing in Washington and with other colleagues who are not in government is how can they use social media or kind of, you know, internet tools like blogs and things like that, where in this day and age of 24/7, you know, media, how can they be a factor in shining the spotlight on states that might be dragging their feet. You know, for instance, you know, imagine back in 2000 where the French were not super in favor of the 13 steps. You know, again, they eventually went along, but that would have been an instance where you could have brought attention to that. No state, very few states, I think, like being singled out for that kind of attention. And I really do think that it's the role of civil society to kind of hold these governments to account and to stop from that kind of behavior. So those are just a few things I would give you, and they're very tactical, but, you know, some of them might work. Oh, and the other, I'm sorry, the one last thing is head of state engagement. I think that, you know, if President Obama has a chance to, you know, speak with President Mubarak in April, you know, and really try to push forward the U.S.-Egyptian relationship, which started, you know, with his speech in Cairo last year, you know, that could make a difference. You know, and also I think it's worth the Egyptians trying, realizing that the tactics of the last 15 years haven't worked. They haven't gotten what they wanted. This might be their best chance to do it. And one of the arguments I make to my Egyptian official contacts in Washington is to study the American presidency, because what they will find is that if a president has two terms in office, they will only do ambitious things in the first term. So that means now. So waiting until 2015, I think, will be a missed opportunity. And this is where we need to see more flexibility from non-nuclear weapon states who do believe in disarmament, that they need to basically show some progress so that the Obama administration and other like-minded states can really take that and say, look, the non-proliferation regime is working and multilateralism works, and this is still worth doing.
Hi, David Novak for the Associated Press. I'd like to return to the question of the START replacement treaty. To what extent, from your standpoint, have the Russians been successful in interweaving the question of missile defense into the official negotiations for the replacement deal? You hinted that John McCain was expressing concern that the U.S. might sacrifice, you know, its security abroad, or security measures being taken abroad, for the sake of a quick treaty signing. So that would suggest that he, at least, is worried that it is a sticking point.
Right.
What are your views on that?
Well, this is a question that probably Alexei should also comment on if he wants to. But, you know, I'm not in the official negotiations, and it's actually sometimes really hard to find out what's been going on. I think that, you know, Rose Gaudemiller, who is a former colleague of ours, you know, I think she is doing a great job trying to run that negotiation and keep it on track, particularly in that it was a very aggressive schedule for trying to negotiate this. In terms of, you know, to what extent it has taken root as an issue, as far as I can tell from the outside, I don't think it really has. Because if it had, I don't think we would be hearing we wouldn't have the high-level contacts between President Medvedev and Obama as recently as I think last week, where they were pressing for both sides to conclude. So I think if this was something that was really, you know, on the agenda, you know, I don't think we would have seen that kind of behavior. And I think the other thing to keep in mind is that I think that the Obama administration was sensitive to some of the Russian concerns about missile defense in Europe, and we see that in the missile defense review that was released in September, and that there was an adjustment, you know, and that was based on a review that the real threat of, you know, Iranian missile capabilities required an adjustment. And, you know, I think we're trying to clarify that, you know, what the intentions are of those missile defense deployments.
Well, since you invited me to comment as well, I may comment. I think that of all the questions discussed in START follow-on treaty, this particular one has the least significance. It has no significance at all. It's purely a symbolic issue. Because even if there is a phrase in the preamble, which probably will be there, that there is interaction between strategic offensive forces and defensive forces, and both sides recognize it, it obliges nobody to nothing. Okay, there is interaction, so what? So what? Next, it doesn't mean that the next START treaty will have to include particular limitations on ballistic missile defense. It's up to positions of both sides during next negotiations, and the United States will be free to say we do not recognize that there are limitations are needed, because we develop ballistic missile defense not against Russia but against others, and again and again. So of all the issues which are being discussed, this has purely symbolic significance, and I think that it was inflated out of any proportion to its real, both for by Russia, because it doesn't help Russia in any way at these negotiations or at future negotiations, or for the United States, because it doesn't oblige them in any way, either now or in the future. Пожалуйста, еще вопросы или комментарии? Так вот, профессор Тимирбаев, потом там.
Thank you very much for your very frank discussion. Of course, you made a very distressing picture of what may happen under the new conflict. And probably you are right.
Ближе немножко держите.
Because there will be, as to follow on treaty, START treaty, I hope it will happen. It will be signed. But CTB, you said maybe next year. And I'm wondering if the Democrats will lose a few seats in the Senate, as you said they might. Then there is no chance next year for CTB, right?
Just makes it harder.
Yes, yeah. But as you know, that CTB has always been the focus of insistence on the part of non-nuclear weapon states. And this matter is even reflected in the preamble of the treaty, as you, I'm sure, know. So how do you see the future of the non-proliferation regime if this conference collapses, as was the case with the 2005 conference? How do you see the future of the regime? We have many challenges, and the amount of challenges will grow with every coming year, because nuclear energy is developing. They don't say anymore the word renaissance. They drop this term from statements, but recently President Obama announced that the U.S. is going to rejuvenate its nuclear energy program. And the same thing is going on almost everywhere, especially in Asia, but also in Latin America. And these are all challenges, because you cannot divide nuclear and non-nuclear, military and non-military use of nuclear energy, very unfortunately. But science is unable to do this. So I want your view,
sure,
frank view,
great,
as you did in your presentation, of how do you see the future of this regime?
Great, thank you very much for that. And it's always tough when you get a question that's posed so eloquently and then ask, what is the future of the non-proliferation regime? Assuming that I don't have a crystal ball, let me just give you my reaction to this. A failure of the review conference, you know, and if we're using failure defined as the failure to achieve a consensus final declaration, I don't think dooms the non-proliferation regime wholly. And let me say why, for a few reasons. One is, we have to put the review conference in context. It is meant to chart progress in terms of how well we've done in the past and where we need to go in the future. It is important, but I don't believe it is the entire regime. And I think it's a mistake to try to make the fate of the regime rely only on the review conference, and for the reasons I've outlined. But in terms of an example of why I think the regime will go forward, it's exactly what you said. 2005 was a disaster. It's 5 years later, we're still here. I mean, the regime is battered, and it will probably is in for more of a beating, but it will still be there. And on the specific issues that you've raised, we have other mechanisms for managing them. So, for instance, on the spread of nuclear energy, I think there's a few things we can do here, and they're not necessarily contingent on the review conference. One is the strengthening of the IAEA. That has to do with, you know, ensuring that it has the appropriate budget and resources, but it also is part of the IAEA and particularly the Director General making use of the authority it has. You know, and I think that with Director General Amano, we're starting to see a different kind of leadership in place, and I think that that might play out in one way. Another way of looking at the nuclear energy problem, and keeping in mind that, you know, I think this global financial crisis has put a bit of a has had a dampening effect on some of the nuclear energy enthusiasm, is to remember the role of private nuclear industry. I mean, we have heard, you know, Anne Lauvergeon from Areva talk about kind of what goes into their decision making. They are not looking to sell their nuclear or deal in nuclear trade with just any country. I mean, they're looking at specific criteria, and their efforts underway in order to get, you know, nuclear industry to really think about non-proliferation measures as they make their business decision. I think that's something, again, the review conference doesn't have a lot to do with, but could actually strengthen efforts to prevent the further spread and use of nuclear weapons. The other thing we might see is the emergence of more of these mechanisms like the six-party talks. And although the six-party talks has an uneven track record of success, it is a mechanism for trying to deal with the situation with North Korea. Can we imagine something similar to that emerging over the next few years with other proliferation challenges? You know, possibly. Do we see the UN Security Council deciding to take some other roles? For instance, Resolution 1887, it was non-binding. Can you imagine if the review conference is a failure that it gets reintroduced in a way that has different language that actually makes it binding on states? So in that way, you know, I would just tell you at heart, I'm actually a more optimistic person than I probably seemed in my presentation. I just think that what will happen is we're going to see these different mechanisms of the broader non-proliferation regime operating in different ways. And it's, you know, it's not the concerted action that we would all love to see as part of a strong non-proliferation regime, but I think the regime will continue to function. It won't be optimal, but I don't think we're going to have any other choice. So.
Thank you. Вопрос здесь, а потом там еще был. Пожалуйста, please.
Thank you very much. Two brief comments. First of all, I do agree that there is life after a failed NPT review conference, as we see. Not only that, I at the time, but maybe a little bit myopic of my CTBT past, was quite relieved that the NPT review conference failed to reach consensus, because under the circumstances, consensus with the Bush administration in place would have meant a severe watering down of what had been agreed in 2000. So actually the starting point now is much better than if you would have had a consensus in 2005. The second point is, I like this idea of defining success or failure of these review conferences. Indeed, the whole issue that you have with consensus decisions of the hostage taking, one bad character can spoil the system, as we see also in this verification thing of the test ban. I think, and that's the point I was going to make, my memory serves me well, but Roland is here in the room and his memory is even much better on IEA, but in 1990, I think the review conference failed, but there were group positions that had been worked out that for a number of years served as guidelines for these countries to follow as in tackling these problems. And this kind of thing indeed could be done. A group of countries could say, listen, given the circumstances and what we worked out at this conference, even though we didn't reach consensus, this is the policy we're going to follow in the next 5 years and so on and so forth. We mentioned that. But I think I like the idea, and I think there is some sort of a precedent in 1990, which is quite a while ago.
Right. And that's, you know, I that's where... That's where I think.
But another group would say something different.
Well, but that wouldn't get them to happen.
Right. And that's where I think, you know, when I talk about kind of political entrepreneurism, I'm asking states to kind of think beyond the final consensus declaration. One of the things, and I just forgot to say this about spoiling behavior and how to avoid it, or what to do with it once it happens. When I interviewed, I think I interviewed 18 non-nuclear weapon states and then experts and officials from the P5 for my last report, one of the consensus and what I mean consensus, I mean one of the largely agreed to ideas was that a review conference spoiled by one or a few players is not a failure. And so this is about a new political sensibility amongst a lot of states saying, spoilers, do what you want. They're still willing to find a way to put that to the side and not allow them, not enable them to actually call it a failure. And I think that that's a different political context than what's happened in previous review conferences. So they'll have to deal with that.
Thank you. I would like to ask whether you think that
Please tell us who are you.
Pardon? Oh, now you hear me?
Your okay. name? Yeah.
Since there's been discussions going on recently, I would like to ask you whether you believe that there's a realistic perspective that U.S. nuclear arsenals will soon be removed from countries in Europe.
Okay, so the issue of nuclear weapons in Europe. there are people in this room who can probably speak to that a lot better. The one thing that I have heard is there was a decision made in the Obama administration that the Nuclear Posture Review would not preclude any decisions that actually needed to be made within the NATO strategic concept discussion. So with that, and that statement was made back in December or January, and it was by an official off the record. And what that basically meant was that the NPR is unlikely to say, we're taking tactical nuclear weapons out of Europe. And that's at least was my understanding. I don't know whether things have changed, particularly once President Obama has engaged the document, which has only happened, or the policies, which has only happened very recently. I think that that conversation about the future of nuclear weapons in Europe is going to happen within NATO. My hope is that it will get the attention it deserves, whereas right now when you talk to the U.S. ambassador to NATO about what his day is like, he says 95% of his day is about Afghanistan. And it's unclear to me whether the current parts of the process on the NATO strategic concept have really delved into some of the deep issues about the role of nuclear weapons. One thing I will say is I think NATO needs to have a really honest conversation about what that debate is about. And what I think it's about, and this is just my view, is that some of the newer NATO states believe that the Article 5 clause of NATO, which is coming to the common defense, doesn't apply to them. And that's why they want to have the security of the NATO, of the US nuclear umbrella. My issue with that is, well, what are these newer states' real security concerns? If it's about cyber threats, if it's about more conventional threats, I don't know that some obsolete nuclear weapons are really the right response. And I think if we're being serious and honest as allies, we should have an honest conversation about what the real threat is and what the appropriate response is. And I think if that conversation happens, I don't know that the answer we get is status quo. I think we need to think about something different. But that'll be up to a lot more states than the United States to decide what happens.
Пожалуйста, еще. Пожалуйста. Wait for the mic.
This is Sylvia Said. And
please present yourself.
Yeah, I'm actually telling you my name. I'm Sylvia Said Baracha from the South Asian Strategic Stability Institute, Pakistan. First of all, I'd like to thank you for the comprehensive discussion that you've given us. My question is relatively basic and simple. What do you think, how much the political or non-nuclear issues depend, how much the success of NPT depends upon the non-nuclear issues than the nuclear issues? For example, if you take South Asia, do you think the political issues or the security concerns of the relative states could be addressed before the issue of arms control should come into action? And secondly, how, to what extent should these issues be included into the actual debate? And how the regional approach, how much can it be successful? Thank you very much.
And when you say the how much it should be included in the debate, you mean at the review conference?
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, wherever the arms controls are being discussed, right. At the CD or...
Right. Okay. Well, I don't know what your views are on nuclear weapons in South Asia, but I will give you mine, which is I don't think nuclear weapons in India and Pakistan have actually helped the security situation in South Asia. I think since the 1998 tests on both sides, although we have not seen outright conventional war, as has been previously the case, we have seen the increase of low-intensity conflict, and we start to see now some more destabilizing elements in terms of terrorism. You know, and of course, there is a broader situation in South Asia, which isn't just about India and Pakistan anymore. It's about Afghanistan. It's about these very complex relationships and how all of these states and other states in the region are connected. And then, of course, you have the big kind of elephant in the room, which is U.S. re-engagement in South Asia after 9/11. And I think that that has really changed and influenced a lot of behaviors. So in terms of kind of what's the relationship of nuclear weapons and arms control and disarmament and non-proliferation to some of these other security concerns, I don't know that we should choose. I think that if we can find opportunities to make progress on any of these steps, we should. And for me, this particularly comes in the form of confidence building measures, you know, and particularly between India and Pakistan. How do we make, you know, there has been good progress in recent years on this. You know, how do we continue that? How do we, you know, the issue between India and Pakistan is not just for those two states. I think it's of concern to the broader international community and also other states in the region. And I just think that we, you know, in this post 9/11 world where there are threats from non-state actors, we have Al-Qaeda that's talking about nuclear terrorism, we've seen illicit networks, you know, in Europe and in other parts of the world, I think we need to come to grips with the fact that these weapons and these materials are a threat in and of themselves, and that the supposed benefits of them are probably outweighed by the true liability that they represent. That's going to take, though, I think, a real change in thinking amongst defense planners in a lot of countries about what nuclear weapons mean for them and mean for them in terms of their role in the world. And I think we've missed out, you know, as I answered before, I think we missed out on some real opportunities for India in particular and Pakistan in theory to follow suit for really demonstrating some strong leadership on the nuclear issues. In terms of to what extent it should be in these issues, particularly in South Asia, should be debated at the review conference. I don't think this is the review conference's comparative advantage. I think that Pakistan, Israel, India, and North Korea should certainly attend the review conference as observers. They've done that in the past. I think they have a stake in what's being discussed, but it seems, you know, a little counterintuitive to try to have a real conversation about these states when they're not actively involved in the conversation. So I don't think that now is the, I don't think the review conference is the right place to try to discuss some of these issues.
You wanted another one?
The sense which one gets from your talk has been that there seems to be a new trend emerging, that nuclear energy debate is perhaps going to be discussed into other sectors of power, whether it's private enterprise and others, and non-proliferation perhaps needs to be addressed through new mechanisms. If that is the case, then how do you actually foresee the future of the non-proliferation regime? Because this, like the Indo-US deal, is actually bringing a structural decay into the NPT's structure. And most importantly, there is a credibility of crisis. There's a credibility of crisis between countries which are considered to be leading the technology debate and countries which are perhaps represented by NAM and other countries, rightly or wrongly, whatever the perception, are still linked to the peaceful uses of nuclear energy and application. So if that divide goes, you could actually have a real implosion and a rethink on the entire concept of non-proliferation. And how would you actually embed that? because these two trends are definitely not supporting each other?
That's a tough question, and one that's probably requires a much longer answer than I will give it. I mean, I think one thing to remember again is that, you know, the nonproliferation regime at its heart and, you know, the cornerstone and foundation of it is the nonproliferation treaty. But because of that, there are some states that are exempted from the obligations of the NPT. So I think it, again, is it's an unfair burden on the NPT itself and the review conference to ask it to kind of to deal with the some of the concerns that arise from things like the US-India deal and some of the other states that aren't party to the review conference, to the NPT. That said, the US-India deal came about because of geopolitics and a certain political context where the opportunity was available for that deal to be made. And if you agree with that, then there's, and this is the more optimistic part of me, that thinks that a day will come where new deals can be struck. And in this time, instead of undermining the nonproliferation regime, there might be an effort to actually strengthen it. So imagine the debate that may eventually happen about India getting a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. And again, I think that day is far in the future. But imagine when it happens. Isn't that an opportunity for us to really start asking the Indians and any other state that would want to aspire to such status to take on the same obligations that other nuclear weapon states have? You know, so what I'm counting on is that geopolitics can change, and I think it's really hard to answer your question just looking at today's context because this is all fluid. Right, the global economic crisis has made a difference. The way change in leadership at the IAEA has made a difference, and that's one person, you know, who I think, you know, has changed, you know, some of this stuff. And in terms of your question about the credibility issues, I think a lot of people acknowledge it. Some of the work that I have done has been really trying to better understand the views of non-nuclear weapon states and whether there's any kind of quid pro quo between progress on disarmament from nuclear weapon states and more nonproliferation obligations from non-nuclear weapon states. And the answer I received was no, there are no immediate or automatic bargains to be had. So if the US ratifies the CTBT, it doesn't mean that that Brazil, for instance, will adopt the additional protocol. You're not gonna see that kind of immediate transaction. Yet, that seems to be the basis of the credibility gap, which is, you know, are nuclear weapon states doing enough to disarm, and then are non-nuclear weapon states doing enough on nonproliferation? What I think is going to happen is it takes small steps to actually create the conditions whereby you can come to new understandings about what's necessary for this security environment.
Спасибо. Еще вопросы, комментарии, пожалуйста.
I'm Dmitry Kovchegin from Booz Allen Hamilton Moscow office. I wonder what's your view on Obama's securing nuclear material priority, because, well, you touched upon this issue very briefly. And is it as bad as anything else, or is it better?
So my view on President Obama's effort to secure vulnerable nuclear materials in the future of the effort. I think it's a good effort. I mean, I think part of it was born out of domestic politics. I mean, this was a campaign promise of his. So probably, and he had, when he was a senator, he worked with Richard Lugar, who, you know, has headed up these cooperative threat reduction programs, and I think he was heavily influenced by those programs. And I think what he sees is that this is a political opportunity and it's a real threat, and he's trying to offer his best solution for dealing with this. Nuclear terrorism, the concept of it, the threat of it, is a big deal for a lot of people in the United States, particularly politicians. And if this is something that he can do that the Senate is not included in, so he can kind of actually achieve something that doesn't require Congress's approval explicitly, I think he's going to do it. The other thing that I think is interesting is, let's see how successful it is as a long-term measure. Because it's an interesting example of how you can use kind of a G20 concept towards this issue, where you basically say, we're not going to discuss this at the review conference. Let's just get all the key stakeholders in the same room and try to come to some agreements. And again, it's in reality, it's pre-negotiated before they get into the room. But the idea being, these are all states that have nuclear materials, want to secure their materials, want to get rid of it, whatever it is. Let's have all those people in the room rather than, you know, a bunch of states that may not have as much of a claim on the issues. In terms of what will come of it, my understanding is that the Russians have already agreed to host the next summit, which is, will be 2 years later. So there's at least that in terms of the future.
Пожалуйста.
Виктор Мурогов, National Research Nuclear University. Let me turn again question of nuclear renaissance, nuclear power, and non-proliferation. In this century, administration of President Bush arise very interesting international initiative, global nuclear power partnership and nuclear power development. It was supported a few, not more than 25 countries and International Atomic Energy Agency. You didn't say anything about this. What this means is that?
Oh, you're talking about the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership? There were two parts to that. I mean, one part of it was about creating fuel supply assurances, and then the other part was, I think, trying to restrict where there would be energy enrichment and reprocessing, if I remember correctly. But Alexei, maybe you remember better.
If it's GNEP, then it's much more to it. It's also development of new secure nuclear power.
Right, proliferation, resistant technologies.
Yes. Mm.
I think it's been broken into a few pieces, and I think that, you know, GNEP as a concept, when it first came out, because it was tied to this effort of restricting what states would have reprocessing enrichment technology, very quickly became a, well, excuse the pun, a radioactive concept where there wasn't a lot of support for that, particularly internationally. That said, there was support for fuel supply assurances and trying to develop the, in the, what is it called? The Article 4, that forum where they do the energy discussion, the technology discussions. It's, I think some of those efforts have gone on probably more under the Department of Energy and the National Nuclear Security Agency, but in terms of being really high up on the priority list, I don't think it's there, and I think it's maybe some elements are there, but under a different name.
Пожалуйста, еще вопросы, комментарии? If there is none, I will ask one question and make two short comments.
Yes.
Yeah. First question. A few days ago, there was a lot of excitement here in Russia about the declaration, official declaration by the United States government on eliminating and utilizing half of its nuclear stockpile, nuclear weapons stockpile. And I was asked some questions by mass media, but couldn't find real sources. Could you comment on that, explain what was really declared by the government, whether the number of existing weapons in stockpile was given so that we know how much is one half?
Yeah, is it about the deployed or in the reserves?
No, those which are in stockpile, not deployed, but in storages.
Did this happen recently?
Just
two days ago. I was traveling, so I don't know the answer to that question. And I'm sorry, I haven't actually picked it up in other news media. But if I find the answer to that, I will let you know.
Okay,
I'll send you
okay.
something.
Now, I'd like to make two short comments. I think that I think that it's not quite justified to be complacent about results of the next NPT review conference. I think that they will be very important because having a second conference, which doesn't produce any tangible results but a few general declarations after the disastrous conference of 2005, would set the trend towards NPT regime, gradual disintegration and weakening and eventually fading away, because the treaty will stay, but all efforts to make it stick will be on the downhill. Besides, since the next conference will be only 5 years later, that's in 2015, this very bleak situation with respect to NPT would start to affect future negotiations on strategic arms reductions. If we are to proceed with negotiations on strategic arms reductions after the START follow-on treaty, the prospects of non-proliferation will play a very important role in the willingness of both Russia and the United States and other countries which are expected to get somehow involved into the process. And that will be affected by the situation of the efforts at enhancement of non-proliferation regime. So also, I understand that there is no way the new treaty will be ratified. We will be very lucky if it's signed before the NPT review conference. But a major political campaign on the importance of the new treaty and the determination of nuclear weapon states to proceed with further reductions should start to create positive climate for the NPT review. And one other thing about an NPT review is that we have to pick up one high priority issue, which both is very important and relatively realistic as the goal for the NPT review. There is a broad number of things that you've mentioned, but I think that one major issue, most important issue, is universalization of 1997 additional protocol. Mm-hmm. That should be put in the center of NPT review conference, in my opinion. And all efforts should be made to promote this issue, in particular providing recommendation to nuclear suppliers group to include signing and ratification of additional protocol by recipient countries as a condition for all future deals on nuclear technology and nuclear materials. Yeah. Without that, all other things are, by definition, are not important enough or not achievable, including the Article 10. How can we expect make Article 10 more stringent if we do not have reliable, comprehensive regime to detect violations and so on? That's one comment. Another comment is that if the nuclear posture review of the United States comes out with a statement that the primary purpose of nuclear weapons is deterrence of nuclear weapons used by other countries, I think that would be also a disaster. Yeah. Because that will be no different from the official policy of the United States and other nuclear weapon states during the last 50 years.
Right.
That will be just repeating something that Bernard Brody said in his initial book on nuclear deterrence, that the primary purpose of nuclear weapons is deterring the use of nuclear weapons. It will be like a mountain giving birth to a mouse. After all the declarations and expectations, either done by Obama or associated with Obama, coming up with a banality,
yep,
that was already a well-accepted fact, would be really a very bad outcome. And I would draw your attention to recent Russian new military doctrine publication.
Yep.
Actually, Russia made a serious step forward in moving nuclear weapons away from the forefront of nuclear strategy and security policy. Yeah. In spite of all the improvisations of various experts and officials on preventive strike, preemptive strike, nuclear doctrine that was officially adopted,
yeah,
sets only two conditions under which Russia would contemplate using nuclear weapons. Very strict, very cautious, very conservative, I would say. First of all, it says Russia may use nuclear weapons in response to use of weapons of mass destruction, that includes chemical and biological, against Russia or its allies. It's very defensive stance. Second, it says Russia will use nuclear weapons in a large-scale conventional war against Russia. By the way, allies are excluded from that, only against Russia. Under circumstances in which the very existence of Russian state is put under question. That's not exactly a no first use, but it's as close to no first use as can be done unilaterally by a nuclear weapon state in a situation when other nuclear weapon states either flatly reject anything like that, no first use, or declare no first use in a purely propagandistic way without any relationship to their actual forces, capabilities, and operational planning. By the latter example, I mean China and India. So that, I think, should be a good example for the United States.
So just a few quick responses. And Alexei, again, thank you very much for bringing all of these people together and for this conversation, which I will end soon because I'm sure everybody's eager to leave. The one thing, you know, a lot of what I said, I was just trying to paint the landscape of what's happening, and I should be clear about what my own actual views are. I did not in any way intend to seem capricious about there not being or sanguine about there not being any results from the NPT review conference. All I'm trying to argue is we might have to look for alternative ways of getting results. So I definitely want to see progress and success. I just want to make sure we're not handicapped by some of the traditional mechanisms for capturing it. And in terms of universalization of the additional protocol, I totally agree with you. It's one of the key recommendations I make that the review conference should focus on it. But I think we're going to have challenges from countries like Brazil, who, you know, have their reasons for what they feel about it. And by the way, one of the things a Brazilian official said to me was the first victim of the U.S.-India deal was the additional protocol in Brazil. So some really interesting insight into how some of these states are thinking about the additional protocol as it relates to other non-proliferation measures. And the last thing I'll say on the NPR, there are people who would argue that even that very unsatisfying formulation that the primary role of nuclear weapons is to deter nuclear attacks against the United States and allies, they would argue that that actually is an improvement from the Bush administration's, the leaked portions of the Bush administration's NPR, where they included the idea of preemption, or actually prevention, to be very specific, and chemical and biological threats. So for some people, that is actually a narrowing away from the Bush administration's policies on it. And I am aware of the new Russian military doctrine. It was sent to me in English a few days ago, so that was really helpful. And I think your interpretation of what it means is really important, and I hope that if you're right, that the United States picks up on that and that they can meet Russian leadership on this issue with more leadership. And I agree with you, we need to get past rhetorical support for no first use and make sure that in real operations and action that's what we're actually doing. So with that, I will at least say thank you to all of you. You've asked some really tremendous and interesting questions, and you know, I'm always available by email, so we can keep our global contact together. And I also wanted to thank the Carnegie Moscow Center for hosting this. And it was a really great opportunity to see Carnegie in action here in Moscow.
Thank you, Dipti. It was a great pleasure and a privilege to meet you, to listen to your very comprehensive and insightful presentation. And please join me in thanking Dipti for coming here and telling all these things to us.